Thank you, Tom. Good morning, everyone. Beautiful day. It was a beautiful week. And, of course, the highlight of the week we've already heard about was the Seven Mountains Preteen Camp. I think there were 201 people there. I think that was right. That's quite a few people at a preteen camp. I think, what was it, about 80 preteens? Something like that. And there were 17 1-to-3-year-olds. 17 So there is a future for our church. It's coming. It's growing. It's coming. Okay. So we just need to nurture it and help it go the right way. And that's what camp is all about. I heard quite a bit about it from my wife. I wasn't there. I'm sorry. I did visit to deliver something and pick something up, but other than that, I wasn't there. But there were two elders that were supposed to be there, and they had kind of key jobs of leading different activities and teaching and things like that. Because of illness in the families, they weren't able to be there. So other people picked up the load, took the load, did their jobs, and everybody just seemed to work together. And there was a lot of work. Like I say, there was more workers than there were children. But at that age, that's kind of how it normally is. In fact, the 1-to-3-year-olds, one of the parents or grandparents usually came with them, I believe. So anyway, it takes us all working together to do something like this, and it's just very inspiring to see and very encouraging, and you know, it's just good to have a good report of an event like that. So this year, the Seven Mountains Preteen Camp, the focus was on Esther. And, of course, all of you know the story of Esther. It's one of our favorite stories in the Bible. It's a very inspiring story about a young lady who, even though she had her fears and, apprehension, she also had lots of courage and conviction, and she went ahead and did the right thing. And just her story is a really inspiring story. It's one that the young children can learn a lot from and can relate to. Because during life, we're all going to have problems. There's always going to be things come up that seem like a crisis or seems like somebody is against you. And we need to learn how to deal with those things. And the great thing was she became the queen in Persia. The king's name was King Ahasuerus. I believe that's how you say his name. But he's also known in history as Xerxes. So you probably heard in Greek history, Xerxes. Well, that was the king that Esther was queen. And the king after Xerxes, his name was Artaxerxes. Now, he was the king during the time of Ezra and Nehemiah. So, to really relate it all in history, Esther was first, then came Ezra, then came Nehemiah in the historical line. Now, Artaxerxes made a decree that because the people of Judah were in captivity, first under Babylon, when Persia took them over, they were still in captivity, many of them under the Persians. But he made a decree that any of the people of Israel could return to Jerusalem. And so Ezra was the leader of that group, and many, I don't remember the number, many did return to Jerusalem and the surrounding area. And Artaxerxes gave them financial assistance, so that they could properly worship God in the temple at Jerusalem. And he seemed to be a kind, considerate king. And he was the king of Persia for 41 years. Today, I want to focus on one of Artaxerxes' servants. He had a servant who was outstanding and, to me, very inspiring. I mean, when I read the story of this guy, he raises things to a different level to me, spiritually. And a very, very good guy to try to emulate, and we can relate to, because he was human, just like we are. He was a Jew, and he was a descendant of the Jews that had been deported from Judah. Now, this was around the mid-400s B.C. Remember, the Israelites had been deported from the nation of Israel back around 722 B.C. That was a long time before this event happened. The Jews had been deported around 600 B.C., some of them a little later, 588 or something. But it still had been a long time since they had been deported. So he was a descendant of one of those. His name was Nehemiah. Nehemiah. And there is a book in the Bible about Nehemiah. And Nehemiah was the cupbearer of the king. He was the cupbearer of the king. And that sounds like a real menial task. So you just bring the cup in and give it to the king. But no, this was an important and honored position. It was important because he had to make sure that the king's wine or his drinks did not get poisoned. You know, a lot of people, there was intrigue and stuff, and a lot of people wanted to get rid of the king because the king had power. And one of the best ways to do it was to poison him. So the cupbearer would normally drink a sample before saying it was okay and giving some of that to the king. And it was an honor to have the position of cupbearer, because that meant that the king trusted you. The king looked upon Nehemiah as being loyal, honest, and uncorruptible. And he wasn't even a Persian. He was from one of the other nations. But he had, you know, he was kind of like Daniel in that sense. He was really highly looked upon by the king. So having this position gave Nehemiah the opportunity to have interaction with the king, especially during the times of the day when the king wanted a drink and wanted to relax. And a cupbearer needed to be well-trained and etiquette. And he had to be good at selecting the best wines. And he had to be a good listener. And he had to be a good conversationalist. It was important that he would be positive and that he was cheerful. That was very important. So as we read the story, we see the hand of God placing Nehemiah in that position at that time. It was through God's blessing that he was somehow chosen to be the cupbearer. And it was a blessing for the whole nation, as we shall see. Now the story goes, one day Nehemiah's brother, who had gone to Jerusalem, came back to Persia, and he returns with a disturbing report. He reports that the Jews are in great distress and are persecuted. Jerusalem's wall is broken down, and the gates of the city have been burned. The people of the city are defenseless. Enemies could easily attack them. Enemies could come in at night and steal from them, or they could just hit and miss, destroy their property. Says they were under reproach. The people were under reproach. And it just, the people around them had a negative view about the people of the city because the city looks so run down, it looks so looks, you know, like they hadn't taken care of things. Anyway, this report disturbed Nehemiah. It really bothered him that Jerusalem was allowed to be this way. And he resolved to do something about it. So what is the first thing that Nehemiah did? So I want to go to Nehemiah chapter 4. Nehemiah chapter 4. Most of my sermon is going to be in the first couple of chapters of Nehemiah, because there's no way I can talk the whole story of Nehemiah in one sermon. But I just want to give you a taste. Nehemiah chapter 1, verse 4 says, and he's speaking in the first person here, "When I heard these words, the words of his brother telling about the city, I sat down and wept and moaned for days." It really got to him. He was really upset. "And I was fasting and praying before the God of heaven." So the first thing that he did is he fasted and prayed. He fasted and prayed. That's the most important thing you can do when there's something upsetting to you, when there's something that you don't know how to deal with. And we're given the opportunity here in verses 5 through 11 to see one of his prayers. And I think it's very instructive to see what he prayed about and to see how he prayed. And we can learn from that in our own prayers of things to pray about. So it tells us what was on his mind and what he prayed about when he faced this situation. So in verse 5, he said, "I beseech you, O Lord God of heaven, the great and awesome God, who preserves the covenant and loving kindness to those who love him and keep his commandments." This is his beginning of his prayer. He's praising God. He calls God the great and awesome God. He points out that God gives favor to those that love him and keep his commandments. He's very supportive of God's instructions, God's way of life. And he points out that God keeps his covenant. God has a covenant that he promised Israel, and God keeps his end of the covenant. So it starts out very positive, and of course, notice the praise of the great God of heaven. And then verse 6, "Let your ear now be attentive and your eyes open to hear the prayer of your servant, which I am praying before you now, day and night, on behalf of the sons of Israel, your servants, confessing the sins of the sons of Israel, which we have sinned against you. I and my father's house have sinned." So he asked God first to please hear his prayer. He's coming in a humble frame of mind. God, please hear my prayer. Please, please. And he prayed on behalf of all the Israelites, not on behalf of himself so much. He was praying on behalf of all the Israelites. And he realized the reason that they had gone into captivity, the reason things had gone bad for them, was because of their sins, the sins of the whole nation. And he admitted that they had sinned. Even his father's house had sinned. And it was wrong. He was repentant. When he came before God, he was repentant. And then verse 7, he continues this thought, "We have acted very corruptly against you and have not kept the commandments, nor the statutes, nor the ordinances, which you commanded your servant Moses." Because Moses had warned them several times you know, keep my commandments and you will be blessed. Disobey my commandments and you will be cursed. There's chapters in Deuteronomy that talks about the blessing and cursings. So he admitted, we have not kept your commandments. They didn't treat one another the way they should. They didn't honor and serve God. They allowed other gods to come into their religion. So the prophecy that God would scatter them. Okay, verse 8. Notice, remember the word which you commanded your servant Moses, saying, if you are unfaithful, I will scatter you among the peoples. Yep, remember that. That was commanded many, many years ago to Moses, and that really happened. They were unfaithful. God warned them many times, but they were scattered. They were scattered all over that part of the world. And I don't know, nobody really knows where all the Israelites went. The Jews were a little more confined because they kind of kept to their religion a little more, and many of them returned. So, but that prophecy was fulfilled, like I said, almost 300 years prior to when he was praying this prayer. In the 700s BC. But verse 9, but if you return to me, this is what God had said, and keep my commandments and do them, though those of you who have been scattered were in the remotest part of the heavens or the earth, I will gather them from there and will bring them to the place which I have chosen to cause my name to dwell. So at that time, the place where he'd caused his name to dwell was Jerusalem. That's where the temple was. So he reminds God, remember this is a prayer, he's reminding God of the promise that if they would start obeying, that he would gather his people together and they would have a place to worship him. And that would happen if they repented and returned to keeping his commandments. So he's pointing that out to God and appealing to God. And I think he truly was trying to obey God and to serve God in the right way. Verse 10, they, talking about the Israelites, they are your servants and your people, whom you redeem by your great power and by your strong hand. He reminds God that they were his chosen people. The people that he had saved from Egypt. The people that God had shown miracle after miracle after miracle. Who had brought through the Red Sea. Who had fed manna and quail in the desert. Who had brought water out of the rocks. Who had protected them so many times. They had a special relationship. They were to be his special people. So he reminds God in his prayer about that. And notice these are all things that we could pray about when we are praying. Maybe it's different from some of the things we have prayed about recently, but these are all things we could pray about in our own country, our own situation. And then in verse 11, O Lord, I beseech you. He's very humble here. May your ear be attentive to the prayer of your servant and the prayer of your servants who delight to revere your name. Because I'm sure he wasn't the only servant who revered God's name, who wanted the right things to happen. God, please hear our prayers and make your servant successful today and grant him compassion before this man. He has two special requests. This is the end of the prayer. He has two special requests. Make your servant successful today and grant him compassion. The second one is to grant him compassion and favor from the man or the king. The king. And it says here, I was the cupbearer. to the king. That was the man. He knew that he wouldn't be successful without God's help. He was disturbed about this situation, and he wanted to do something about it, and he knew he couldn't be successful without God's help. And he also knew that he, in his situation, he couldn't do much without the favor of the king. Because he was a foreigner, he really wasn't free to come and go, to quit that job and take another job. He wasn't free to do that. He was a servant. And notice that he pleaded urgency to God, make your servant successful today. You know, that's something it's there. He asked for it. I'd like this to happen right away. Okay? He was bold enough to ask for it. Anyway, in addition to prayer, as we read the story, we will see that he gave this whole situation a lot of thought. What would be a solution to this problem with the walls broken down and the gates burned and the people under reproach? What would be a solution? What could I do? If he did something, what would he need to do? He knew, for one thing, he needed to talk to the king. But he also knew the king, and he knew the timing had to be right. The timing of talking to the king had to be right. He was patient. He was cautious. 4 months went by. He still hadn't talked to the king. He had patience to wait for the right time. It also gave him time to think the whole situation through. Hebrews chapter 6, verse 12 tells us that it is through faith and patience that we inherit the promises. Through faith and patience. And Nehemiah had faith and he had patience. And this wasn't necessarily a promise, but this was... He was going to have God's help. Another man, just reflecting back, that had faith and patience was Joseph. Joseph was a man who had faith and patience that God would work things out. It takes wisdom to see the right timing. Do I be brave and go before the king? Or do I not be brave and risk never doing anything? I'm sure that went through his mind. It bothered him that he needed to talk to the king. So in chapter 2, verse 1, it came about in the month Nisan. This was 4 months later, after he got the report from his brother. In the 20th year of King Artaxerxes, that wine was before him. And I took up the wine and gave it to the king, just like he did any other day. This was just a regular day. He was just going about his job. Now, I had not been sad in his presence. He had been very careful to be very pleasant and cheerful in the presence of the king, in spite of his situation, in spite of how he felt. But the king was very perceptive. And in verse 2, so the king said to me, "Why is your face sad, though you are not sick?" Wow. What a question. He noticed a sadness. Maybe it was a distance away before Nehemiah got to the king. Maybe someone told him that Nehemiah was kind of low and depressed. But notice Nehemiah's reaction. Okay, I'll finish reading. Though you are not sick, this is nothing but sadness of heart. Then I was very much afraid. Why was Nehemiah afraid? Because I think he realized this was the moment he had been praying about. The moment had arrived. The king had provided an opening to discuss the problem. Somehow, the king wanted to talk to him about his problems. But he also had in mind that just a few years earlier, this same king, Artaxerxes, had received a report from a lot of the enemies of the Jews that they were troublemakers and that they were going to rebel against the king. And so the king had issued a decree, the same king, that the work on the rebuilding of the walls of Jerusalem and restoring the city was to stop completely until he would issue another decree. That's over in Ezra chapter 4, verse 21. The enemies of the Jews had poisoned his mind regarding the Jewish people. So that was in the back of Nehemiah's mind. That was one reason he was afraid. He also shows he's very human. It's human to be afraid when we have to deal with tough issues. So Nehemiah was basically going to ask that there would be a decree that the work would be allowed again. And he knew that was the right thing to do. And that Jerusalem be repaired. He had prayed about it. So how did he respond? So he said, verse 3, I said to the king, let the king live forever. Why should my face not be sad when the city, the place of my father's tombs, lies desolate and its gates have been consumed by fire? So first he affirmed to the king that he was on the king's side. He's really telling the king that he really sincerely appreciated him as king, and that he hoped his reign would last a long time. He knew it wouldn't last forever, but may it last a long time. Okay, he was affirming to the king, and the king could see his sincerity. Then he knew that the Persians had a respect for the dead. So he talked about the tombs of his ancestors, which were buried in Jerusalem. And the king had sympathy for that. So after he said that, then the king said to me in verse 4, what would you request? Amazing. You can see God's hand here in giving him favor in the eyes of the king. What would you request? It couldn't have been a better response. The king was opening the door for him to make a request. What would you request? So what should Nehemiah say? And notice what happened. So I prayed to the God of heaven. And what he did was he said a quick, silent prayer. A quick, silent prayer. And it's something we all can do, we probably all have done. When we're in a moment of crisis, we don't know what to say, we say a quick, silent prayer. What should I say, Father? Or give me strength. I don't know what he said. It was quick, I'm sure. And it was silent. So what did he say? I'm sure he said, Father, help me say the right thing. It was one of the things he prayed about. Maybe that's all he asked. Verse 5, I said to the king, and notice he was very respectful, if it pleased the king, and if your servant has found favor before you, send me to Judah, to the city of my father's tombs, that I may rebuild it. So Nehemiah had thought it through. The 4 months previous, he had thought it through. What would he do if he was asked, what is the best solution? He came to the conclusion the best solution was if I would myself go there and oversee the rebuilding of the walls of the city. So the king said to me, the queen sitting beside him, "How long will your journey be? And when will you return?" Doesn't say what he said, but we know from the account he was there 12 years. 12 years? You want to take off work 12 years? Didn't seem to faze the king. he was on board. He was on board. He liked Nehemiah. God had answered the prayer. He had favor in the eyes of this king. And God was going to give him success. He could see the hand of God helping him. He says, "So it pleased the king to send me, and I gave him a definite time. And I said to the king, 'If it please the king, let letters be written or given me for the governors of the provinces beyond the river, that they may allow me to pass through until I come to Judah. And a letter to Asaph, the keeper of the king's forest, that he may give me timber to make beams for the gates of the fortress, which is by the temple, for the wall of the city, and for the house to which I will go.' And the king granted them to me, because the good hand of my God was on me." So he had thought this through. That was a reason for his success, is he had not just put it all in God's hands. He had a plan. He had planned what he would need. He would need legal papers. He would need supplies. He would need building materials, especially timber, big timber. He would need resources to live on while he was there. Everything was granted, and more than what he asked for. And notice, he gave God the credit. He gave God the credit. So when things go well for us, and when God answers our prayer, do we give God the credit? Hopefully we do. We need to really be thankful to our God, because he does answer little requests for us. When God it might have been 4 months since he had started praying about this, but he was patient, and God eventually answered his prayer, and he was very, very thankful. He didn't complain about it taking 4 months. Okay, verse 9. "So then when I came to the governors of the provinces beyond the river and gave them the king's letters," he really did need those letters, because the governors beyond the river were anti-Jewish, and they were anti-anybody that was going to help rebuild the city. But he had the letters. He was smart enough to have the papers. The king says, "I'm to go rebuild this city, and you're to let me through, and you're to help me." Okay, so, and it says, "Now the king had sent with me officers of the army and horsemen." Wow, he even had a military escort to go in case these governors gave him some problems, or, you know, he would have been defenseless on his own. But not with the officers of the army and horsemen with him. They weren't going to mess with them. So we learn in several other places in the book of Nehemiah that Nehemiah was actually made the governor of the province of where Jerusalem was. he was made the governor. Doesn't mention it right here, but it mentioned in two other places he was the governor. And with the governor, he got a salary. He got all kinds of goods to feed a household. It's, there were many, many people that came to his house and ate because he had been granted this governor's salary. But he did not abuse the governor's salary. We learn that too. That's later. Notice a couple of things in this story about Nehemiah and the king. He didn't just complain and bellyache to the king about these evil other people and, you know, how poor we were and all that. He had a plan. He had thought things through. He had planned what needed done. And it seems like this king was on the same wavelength. He was very decisive. He cut to the chase. Your plan is good. He even added a few things to it, things maybe he hadn't thought of. So I ask the question, when we come up against a problem, do we just complain? Do we just sit back and complain and moan and just say how awful is things? Or do we have a plan? Do we have a plan to make things better? Now, maybe we need God's help, just like he did, but do we have a plan? And we take that plan to God. So to be successful, the one thing I pointed out, you need to go to God in prayer. But another thing you need to do is you need to have a plan. Then another thing about Nehemiah that we learned from this story is he gave credit to God. He didn't take the credit himself. If it wouldn't have been for God, none of this stuff would have happened. He'd still be, well, he might not even be the cupbearer. Because the king probably could have got out of favor with the king. He could have been sent to the gallows or whatever they did back in those days. That's what happened a lot of times. Because I'm sure there were a lot of enemies that would have falsely accused him to try to get him removed. But anyway, he gave God the credit. He was saying, I had success because the good hand of God was upon me. He looked upon God in a positive way, the good hand of God. God has a good hand. And God does want us to be successful. God does want things to work out. God does promise us that things will work out in a kingdom that's coming. But he can bless us in this life too. What was the one thing he had prayed for? He had prayed for success, and God granted him that prayer. So to continue to be successful, we need to give God the credit. I want to read just I'm going to stay in Nehemiah, but I just want to read a verse in Psalms 118, verse 23. And we can say this sometimes. This is the Lord's doing. It is marvelous in our eyes. And Nehemiah could say that about his situation. This was the Lord's doing, and it was marvelous. And the story is written for us in the Bible so that we can be inspired by it, so we can be encouraged by it, so that we can learn from it. So God was the reason for his success. In Esther's case, it was a marvelous how God worked things out for Esther and the people of Judah, because he was going to kill all of the Jews, and it got completely turned around. It was God worked things out. That was a great story. God worked things out for Joseph. He was in prison, and then he was made the second highest person in Egypt. God worked things out. Now back to Nehemiah chapter 2, verse 11. So I came to Jerusalem and was there 3 days. So from the capital of Persia to Jerusalem. I think it's about 900 miles. Back in those days, it took 3 or 4 months to get there. I'm sure when he got there, he was tired. And I'm sure he had people there that he knew that were there. For one, he probably knew Ezra. And I'm sure he would have wanted to caught up on things with Ezra. He may have even had family there. It mentions his brother who had come back from Jerusalem the one time. Maybe there was, it doesn't say. It doesn't say what he did, but he was there for 3 days. Not really long when you consider the events that were happening. Maybe there was a Sabbath during this time, and as we learn later in this book, he was very much a promoter of keeping the Sabbath. Then verse 12. And I arose in the night, I and a few men with me. I did not tell anyone what my God was putting into my mind to do for Jerusalem. And there was no animal with me except the animal on which I was riding. So I went out at night by the valley gate in the direction of the dragon's well, and on to the refuge gate, inspecting the walls of Jerusalem. Must have been moonlight or something. They say it must have had some kind of light so they could see. This was at night. Which were broken down, and its gates were consumed by fire. So it truly was in devastation. Then I passed on to the fountain gate and the king's pool. But there was no place for my mount to pass. It was such a rubble there, his animal could not even go through. So I went up at night by the ravine and inspected the wall. Then I entered the valley gate, which is where he had started, and returned. And the officials did not know where I had gone or what I had done. Nor had I as yet told the Jews, the priests, the nobles, the officials, or the rest who did the work. He wanted to see for himself the damage to the walls and the gates. And he went out at night so he could do it privately and make his own personal assessment of what needed to be done. Because his plan was to make a presentation to all the people about what they needed to do. But he wanted to have the credibility that he had seen the gate himself, and he wanted to have the facts of how things were. He could speak with much more confidence and credibility after he had done this. And notice here that he gives God the credit for putting in his mind the things that needed to be done. The plan, the things that needed to be done, he gave God the credit for that. God somehow put that on my mind and caused me to want to get it done and to see how it could be done. So what did he do after he got back? He didn't mess around. Verse 17. Then I said to them, he evidently gathered the people of Jerusalem together. All the people mentioned in the previous verse, which was pretty much everybody, okay? He gathered them together. And he gave them a speech. And he pointed out the situation and the need to fix it. So verse 17, he said to them, "You see the bad situation we're in?" Now maybe they had gotten used to it. Maybe it's been like this for a few months now, a few years maybe. But nothing's going to change. That Jerusalem is desolate and its gates burned by fire. Come, let us rebuild the wall of Jerusalem so that we will no longer be a reproach. And I told them how the hand of my God had been favorable to me. He told them the story of how the king had, God had worked with the king and given him favor. and about the king's words, which he had spoken to me. You know, that was really inspiring to him, but it was also inspiring to the people. And then they said, let us arise and build. So they put their hands to the good work. So, yeah. So he pointed out the situation, the need to fix it, and he encouraged them with the story of how God had given him favor, how God had blessed him. He didn't just order them to do the project. He suggested they do the project. But he persuaded them to do the project. The people said, let's build this wall. Notice the people said, let us arise and build. They were on board. He was able to get them all on board, and it was mostly all on board, the majority on board. They got it. They saw the vision. And notice they put their hands to the good work. This was a good work, something that very much needed done, a good work that very much needed done. You know, Jerusalem was God's special city. Jerusalem was supposed to reflect God and God's people. It was to be beautiful. It contained the people that God was working with. This was where the true God's temple was. So this was important that they rebuild Jerusalem. This actually would reflect good on God and God's way. Notice verse 19. But when Sanballat the Horonite and Tobiah the Ammonite official and Gershom the Arab heard it, they mocked us and despised us and said, what is this thing you're doing? Are you rebelling against the king? So there was some opposition right here from some non-Israelite officials who were governors of, as we learn in other places, governors of the neighboring territories. You know, of course, they didn't want this. They wanted Jerusalem to be down so that they could be powerful. But what they said didn't faze Nehemiah. He knew that God would help them. You know, it was just like what they said, kind of, you read the account, kind of like went in one ear and out the other. And he responded in a way in verse 20. So I answered them and said to them, the God of heaven will give us success. Because he had asked for success. Therefore, we, his servants, will arise and build. But you have no portion, right, or memorial in Jerusalem. So he just said it like it was. You know, you guys are not on, not with it. You're not with us. You might as well leave, get away. That's what he was saying. God's going to give us success. The project's success would be due to the God of heaven. And like I said, Jerusalem was to be special. And sometimes the church is kind of represents or is a figurative Jerusalem. The people of the church are to be special. The people of the church is where God dwells. The people of the church is where God is working. And collectively, we should be beautiful. We should have beautiful attitudes. We should have good spirits. We should be strong in the faith. We should be promoters of God's way. We should be the ones who give God great praise, God the Father and our Lord Jesus Christ. So we have a building to build too. It's in a different sense. Our building is a spiritual building. This was a physical building. But it kind of relates. Over in Nehemiah chapter 6, verse 15. Nehemiah chapter 6, verse 15. So the wall was completed on the 25th day of the month Elul in 52 days. 52 days, they finished the wall. That had to be amazing. Back in that day and age, they didn't have the big equipment. They didn't have the transportation to bring all the supplies in. Wow, 52 days. The people had a will to work, and they worked together. And they had a great leader in Nehemiah. And they had the help of God, the God Almighty, the great and awesome God.